Good morning. You've tuned into the Tuesday morning show. It is Tuesday, May 14th. This is 88.5 KRFY, Panhandle Community Radio. I'm Jack Peterson, joined this morning by Jen Jackson Quintano, again, of the Pro Voice Project as part of our Worth of a Woman series. This is the second of our three-part series. I'll start by saying good morning to Jen. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
So nice to have you here. Last week, we spoke to Dr. Jennifer Hill, author of Birthing the West, A History of Childbirth in the Rural Mountain West, focusing on the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Today, we want to bring the conversation to the here and now. And in that spirit, we have with us Cynthia Dalsing. She is a retired nurse midwife and active volunteer with the Pro Voice Project, as well as active with the Nurse Practitioners of Idaho and Idahoans United for Women and Families. Good morning, Cynthia.
Hi, Jack.
Nice to have you here. And also Catherine Larson, another volunteer with the Pro Voice Project. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Jack.
So let's introduce the two new people in the studio. I recommend listeners go back and listen to our first episode where we kind of talked about the origins of the Pro Voice Project and what you're trying to do. But how did you two get involved? Why did you decide to become involved with the Pro Voice Project? Who wants to answer that one first? Cynthia.
You've been there since moment one.
Yeah.
Pretty much since labor and delivery were given their notice. And that prompted this entire idea from Jen, and she quickly rallied a lot of community members, and she needed somebody who's actually been involved with the labor and delivery process. And Dr. Huntsberger and I were at the first Pro Voice Project program that we had here to just talk about what do these laws mean for Idaho and for our community specifically.
That would be Dr. Amelia Huntsberger.
Yes.
Who has since left our community. And Catherine, how did you become involved in the Pro Voice Project?
So I got involved in this because of my background. I met Jen and heard about the project. My background is really around working with people around difficult issues that are difficult to talk about and problem solve. I've designed a lot of games and simulations and scenarios to help people engage when there are lots of unintended consequences and people can't even talk about it because it's just such a difficult subject. So how do you present and get people talking? So I was super excited about what Jim was doing, and when I met the other volunteers that were there, it was just an incredible group of women, and I decided to jump in.
That seems like it would dovetail nicely with the kind of the story narrative-based approach that Jen is taking with the Pro Voice Project. Yeah. What do you do exactly? What kind of games and things do you have in mind for the Pro Voice Project?
So the games that I worked with in the past, I've done everything from board games to computer simulations to just scenario-based learning in lots of different industries. For this one, I got super excited about the kind of concept of the map where you can go into an imagination. It's not a true game, but there's another panel as well called Architecting, and it was really looking at all of the interrelated elements to ramifications again. Legislative decisions, financial decisions, what happened, you know, what choices we make in healthcare, our social and moral elements, and as well as, you know, the structure of our insurance. And so you start to look at all those complex elements at play, it begs for a game. And I think that's coming in the future. We've set it up, but we haven't actually designed the game yet.
And maybe I can back up there to remind listeners. We talked about this a little bit last week, but part of the reason why we're on here is for this Worth of a Woman exhibit that we've got up at Bluebird Bakery that we just put up this weekend. And so Catherine was talking about some of the panels that we have as a part of that exhibit. And the exhibit is looking at, you know, how we, what women contribute to our community and how we value them and their health care. And we tend to find that we undervalue that care and we put up a lot of barriers to that care. And what Catherine was looking at with her panels is just like the various factors that are involved in that, you know, from financial to legal to social supports and so on, and how if you kind of move those levers around a little bit, you get different outcomes for women and communities. But it's a part of this bigger exhibit that we have up that's intended to spark some conversation in the community on the 1 year anniversary of having lost our access to reproductive health care here.
Let's back up and talk about that. The closure of labor and delivery services at Bonner General Health, which you mentioned that was kind of yourself and Dr. Huntsberger had given a presentation of some kind or kind of talked about what that would mean around that time. And especially once the Dobbs decision came through. But let's talk about the hospital itself. And I guess my question is why did Bonner General Health close labor and delivery in your educated opinions? Because you'll hear people say, well, it was just a financial decision, for example, that it was that labor and delivery was not making any money for the hospital, and so they made a dollars and cents decision to close it down. Is that?
And you know, that could have been enough reason.
Yeah.
Because hospitals are businesses. Businesses close services because they don't get paid enough money to do it. You don't get paid enough money to pay your providers, the rent, the lights. So that was just a part of the decision. We had four exceptionally educated and trained OBGYNs. I mean, we really had a premier staff of OBGYN care here in Sandpoint for a town of this size. However, what complicated this decision was when the laws were passed in Idaho to cause physicians to second guess their decisions in an emergent crisis situation. Am I going to go to jail for saving this woman's life? Am I going to be prosecuted? Am I going to have a lawsuit? That was not helpful. And understandably, some of the doctors said, I don't need to practice in a state where my medical training is being questioned by people who have no medical training. And then the other issue that this little hospital deals with is, in order to do births, you have to have pediatric resuscitation services. I mean, and you have to have a C-section, an operating room going. I mean, you need a lot of support services for a birth. And mostly, hopefully, you don't need use them. But you have to have them up and running 24 hours a day. So it was a very complicated decision the hospital made.
And I think to add to that, you know, you touched on this briefly, but like the reimbursement rates for this kind of care, they're abysmal. And most labor and delivery units are just like barely surviving, especially if you've got Medicaid patients coming in. The reimbursement rates there are really bad. So, you know, there's a sense, I think most people want to distill this to like there is one reason why this happened and you can explain it away with that reason. And it's complex, and I would say that most, if not all, rural labor and delivery units are barely squeaking by, and they're probably not making their hospitals any money. So our labor and delivery unit, we were fortunate to have it, but it was a house of cards, and we were fortunate that that house of cards stood for as long as it did. And then I think you inject this change politically, this legislation in that criminalizes the standard of care, and that just knocked the whole edifice down. So you can't pin it to one thing, and that's part of what this exhibit is all about, is there is a systemic undervaluing of reproductive health care. And somehow we operated within that framework. But then once the laws changed, it sort of became untenable.
You know, what's really interesting is when I first started in the 80s as a midwife, at that point, hospitals pretty uniformly said, we don't make money on OB. That was in 1980. And they made money from gynecologic services and from the many other procedures and services they do. And here we are 50 years later, and they are still making no money from obstetrics because the reimbursement for a birth can be a couple of $1,000s. And when you think about the time that, and that's not just the birth, that's all of the prenatal care, that's the postpartum care, it's a bundled service. So when you think of the 10, 12 months you've spent taking care of that woman and her family, and sometimes for several days in labor and delivery, it just does not add up.
What do, so the hospital, for a variety of reasons, but the hospital closed those services in 2023, right? Do I have that right?
Yes.
What now does a woman in, Kathy, sorry.
So I just wanted to add that having those doctors leave, the hospital has to continue paying the tail of insurance for every time the doctors leave. So the fact that our OBGYNs left because of the political situation further exacerbated the hospital financial situation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're talking a few $100,000. A tail is a insurance policy that is paid to cover a provider who did a delivery, but maybe in 5 years that child would have had a problem and they'll bring it back to court. Mm. It's, most people have no concept of that, but it's quite expensive.
It's the for-profit. I mean, one of the key pieces that you guys are talking about is the for-profit
insurance
challenge of healthcare being driven by that in rural situations. So thanks.
Yeah. What does, I think I was just going to ask what a woman or a family that needs labor and delivery services now in this area, what are their options? What do they do? Where do they go?
They're being encouraged to buy LifeFlight just in case.
Yeah, as a backup, which, you know, that's not really where you want to go mentally.
Yeah.
When you're pregnant, to think, well, I better buy the helicopter insurance. You know, that's...
Sure.
Yeah, so that's one thing that a lot of women are doing. And then most are having to travel to Coeur d'Alene or Spokane for... appointments. I do know that there's a little bit of prenatal care that's being offered, I think a day a week up here. And then we have midwives in the community, you know, so there's that option. So what we're lacking, though, so for instance, my story is I went with a midwife when I was pregnant with our daughter, and I thought, I am strong, I am healthy, if I can run a chainsaw, I can deliver a baby, dang it, you know? That was sort of the sense, and I was living way up Rapid Lightning Road at the time, and things did not go according to plan, and I had to go to Bonner General, and that was a 40-minute drive just to Bonner General. The thought of appending another hour onto that in the winter, my daughter was born in December, that's not ideal, but I needed to have a C-section, so... I come at this, I understand, like, I wanted a home birth. I wanted the midwife experience. That was my goal. And it doesn't always work out as planned. And so it's really nice to have a backstop. It's really nice to have trained physicians at your local hospital in case a problem or an emergency arises. And now we don't have that backstop. So, yes, women are still having home births, and that is wonderful. I just worry that we don't have that specific care option here anymore. And it's a long drive to Coeur d'Alene when you are in labor, and especially if you're in some kind of emergent situation where you need care.
Just the fact that one of the responses to if you're pregnant in North Idaho, get the helicopter ticket. It's like, that is so condescending and such a little pat on the head to women. And frankly, I ran a maternal transport at the University of Utah, and you do not put an unstable pregnant woman on a helicopter in which you have no room to do anything. So just that very idea, I think, to tell women, oh, get the life flight, it's condescending, and I think it's unsafe.
Mm. In your years as a nurse practitioner, midwife, how did you... This was, you retired before the DOS yes. decision took place, yeah. What kind of changes, I guess, did you observe through your, in your career in the way that births were done? And is, I guess, the attitude towards midwifery, is that what, mm-hmm. is that changing? Was that changing during your career? Did you notice that?
Yes, it has been a process. Mm-hmm. Nurse midwives were extremely accepted when they were taking care of poor women in urban or rural areas. Mm. When they started moving into other populations, there was more resistance. Mm-hmm. However, nurse midwives have an incredibly good track record because they identify problems. They can do screening, which is so critical for prenatal care. And then they can consult with OBGYNs or family medicine physicians who cover OB. So in my career, I saw a real kind of opening of having a team approach to taking care of women who are pregnant. And we know from the statistics that the more different variety of medical providers that you have involved with a woman's care, the better her experience, but more importantly, the more likely she is to live and her child to be born at term, which would save billions of dollars in our healthcare world. But it has been a process. And I think more than ever now, we're understanding that because physicians are being deferred and deterred from coming from states, that we're going to need to use a bigger team of practitioners to take care of women.
Cynthia, do you remember the data on doulas and how much doulas' involvement? I mean, because it is a team.
A doula was kind of like a fluff for years. And now doulas are kind of an acknowledged, trained person who actually can be reimbursed by Medicaid in some states. And a doula is kind of like your personal coach for your pregnancy. So they help you kind of navigate the system, remind you when you need to do this or that, or get to appointments, or maybe get you to appointments, but also can be with you in labor and delivery and can be somewhat of an advocate for you, especially when women are in labor. They're not particularly their best advocates at that time. They're dealing with a whole nother experience. So the doula concept is growing now, and it's really, I think, something that we should pay more attention to.
But probably not for those emergency situations.
A doula cannot do a C-section, true. I mean, they can't do a C-section in the ER here. If you need surgery, you need surgery. And a pregnant woman's vascular system is like a Niagara Falls. I mean, you do not want to get behind any problems that you need a surgical solution for. So I think our hospital's doing an admirable job trying very hard to take care of what comes through their door, but I feel like they're being kind of forced to provide care with their hands tied behind their back.
Yeah, I think there have been a few babies delivered in the ER, which is not ideal, and no. I'm not sure that any emergency room physician would really want to be in that situation, but Bonner General is there in that way. And I would love, I'm just going to put this plug in there. I would love it if BGH would come on and educate us on like what they still have to offer and how they're working with other hospitals in the area, and just to cover like what exactly pregnant folks can do to access care and the care that is still available here. I think that would be huge for the community to hear directly from the hospital what those options are in the wake of having lost so many of our care providers here.
And I will add to that, we didn't just lose four obstetricians. We lost four gynecologic surgeons and four primary care providers for women. That was a big gap in our community now.
Yeah,
those women have to go to Spokane or Coeur d'Alene for care for gynecologic emergencies.
And sometimes your gynecologist acts as your primary care physician. So, you know, a lot of women have lost that. And a lot of times gynecologists are sort of the frontline screeners for instances of domestic violence or sexual assault. That's the trusted person that you're really vulnerable with, obviously, that you feel comfortable perhaps sharing those things. So we've also lost four compassionate individuals who kind of watch out for those situations too. It's a big ripple effect. It's much bigger than, oh, well, we can't deliver babies here anymore. It's so much more than that.
Well, and you just talked about the risk in the ER room, and so will those doctors stay? And I just heard a story this morning about how medical school students are not signing up for residencies in states like ours because of the laws and the risk. So the ripple effect is much bigger than even women's reproductive care.
And what's important, Catherine, is that Idaho does not even have an OBGYN residency. So you have to have training outside of the state. So you go to medical school for 3 years, then you do a specialty in OBGYN for 3 years, and then you start to practice. Well, Idaho does not have that 3-year additional training. So physicians have a very high percentage of staying where their residency is after they finish. People want to have residents because that feeds their medical provider pool. So without that, we're getting fewer, and the laws and medical students are saying they don't even want to step in Idaho.
Yeah, I just received an email from a local individual whose daughter is studying to be an OBGYN. She has 1 year left. Her hope had been to come back to Sandpoint, where she grew up. She'd been in touch with Sandpoint Women's Health, and now that's not an option for her. And, you know, in the past 18 months, we've lost 55 reproductive health care providers in the state of Idaho. And in that time, only two have moved into the state. So that's a huge net loss of healthcare providers. It's not just impacting Sandpoint. It's impacting the whole state. And I think we're going to continue to be on this trend of losing care providers until we see a fix to our laws, which are criminalizing care.
When the Dobbs decision passed, Idaho had, in effect, what are called trigger laws that immediately went into effect and made abortion illegal statewide. But when that happened, Bonner General Health did not close its doors the next day. What kind of, what was that period in between like, did insurance companies become involved and say you can no longer provide certain services, or do we know, is this all behind closed doors and we're not sure exactly how?
Well, I think that's where attorneys became involved, and suddenly physicians in emergent situations are like, hey, can someone get the attorney on the phone so I can ask whether I'm putting myself and the hospital in jeopardy?
Yeah, it's 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there is a patient on the table that needs immediate care, but physicians are waiting to hear whether they're going to go to jail, potentially go to prison for performing care. So that's where I think you see this injection of like running things through the legal sphere before coming back to treatment. And so I think there was that period of time because physicians were just starting to realize, oh, this is how this is impacting, how it's impacting my ability to care for my patients. You know, those situations had to come forward where someone is in dire straits and the physician feels like, oh, my hands are tied. And you can only do that so many times before you start questioning, is this the best place for me to practice? You know, I don't want to watch my patients suffer. This goes against everything that I've learned in my training.
And legislators, they said, oh, we've spelled it all out. We have all the conditions of which you would need to make a difficult decision. And in fact, they don't. And they don't believe that they haven't. I mean, our attorney general says this is not really an issue. And in fact, many doctors haven't left Idaho, which it just tells you his priority for women's health. But it took a long time to navigate that uncertainty because they thought initially, okay, how are we going to handle the situation? And it became more clear that there wasn't clear guidance and the criminal prosecution was real and potentially getting worse with bounty laws and going across the state line. I mean, there was a lot of scary language.
And on that legislative piece, so the way that they want to handle it is by keeping putting Band-Aids on it. Oh, well, let's kind of grab...
We'll add this.
Add that. And so it becomes more and more complex, but less and less clear. And I actually met a man who... is a doctor and heard about this and said, oh, you know, this is a liberal thing. The doctors are leaving. They're using it as an excuse, but it's not real. So he came here to practice because he leaned towards pro-life and got in and decided that it wasn't worth losing his medical license. And so he drives to Spokane to practice. So it is difficult when politicians get involved and try to just add more and more laws and more language to correct it when it's complex medical decisions and we're taking the experts out of it.
And actually, your Dr. Rohans, who does a show for KRFY, she gave this situation the perfect term, which is to call providing medical care appropriate medical care to save a woman's life, her fertility, her health. To call it an abortion is a false equivalent. It is evidence-based medical care. If you happen to have a 14-week fetus with a heartbeat, but you have a woman who is septic and going to die, you need to remove that pregnancy potentially so you can take care of her. I mean, every medical situation is so specific, you cannot possibly address this with any kind of language in the laws, and certainly by people who don't even know what they're doing. There is one medical person in the entire legislature, a nurse. Hmm.
It reminds me of the nuclear power industry where I worked, and every time there was a issue, they would write another law. So Three Mile Island happened, and they wrote a bunch of laws. Chernobyl happened, and there are a lot of little incidents. They have a book that's probably 2 feet by 3 feet, and it's filled with a gazillion laws. And when something happens, they open it up to try to figure out what to do, and they all conflict because each one is a different situation. And so trying to address this by covering every possible complication and making it so that women are safer is exactly the wrong direction to go.
Yeah, as Jessica Valenti says, pregnancy is too complicated to legislate. I 100% believe that.
You're listening to the KRFY Morning Show, and this is our second edition of Worth of a Woman, a three-part series talking about the state of women's health care in North Idaho and in our state in general. And elsewhere, our guests this morning, Jen Jackson Quintano, founder and executive director of the Pro-Voice Project. Cynthia Dalsing is here, retired nurse, midwife, and Catherine Larson, volunteer with the Pro-Voice Project. I would like to ask Cynthia if during her career as a nurse midwife, she encountered situations that would now be either illegal or forbidden or at least questionable in the current state. Yeah.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
I worked in three university settings. Mm-hmm. So that's where the most complicated cases come. And probably the easiest one to understand is when a woman is pregnant and the fetus is in a little kind of bubble of water, and if that water should break, it starts to leak out. But the very important thing about the amniotic fluid is that it provides a cushion for a baby. And it also, babies swallow the amniotic fluid and pee it out. So it's replenished, and it's a great little kind of bubble wrap around the baby. I mean, it's also a sterile environment as well. But sometimes those leaks will heal over and you'll be able to kind of continue the pregnancy. But if they don't, you get kind of this very smashed down fetus who is really pretty malformed when they're delivered. I mean, they don't have the cushion. Their lungs aren't developed because they haven't been able to breathe or make breathing movements in utero. And in a university setting, you deal with some very, very difficult situations. I've seen some very severe genetic abnormalities, beautiful little babies that didn't live, and it's OB care and that whole experience of taking care of a family and a mother and a father and grandparents when you're having a traumatic situation anyway is, it's powerful. It's something that that family never forgets. And it's still going. You know, we've all heard the stories of women who have non-viable fetal malformations, and it's cruel to make a woman go to term knowing that her baby will die at birth or die while she's carrying it, and then to deliver a baby who has died. And I've been in those situations, and it's the quietest room in the hospital.
Should we we could take a short musical break if we wanted to, unless anyone has anything to add to that.
I did just yesterday, you know, sort of my collecting stories is my jam. So I come in contact with a lot of them, and just heard one yesterday about an Idaho woman who found out somewhat later in her pregnancy that her baby was not going to live and would in fact suffer when born. And this woman is someone who considers herself pro-life. She's a person of faith. And for her, it was the most compassionate decision she could make for her baby to not have that baby suffer. And so she and her husband, you know, they elected to terminate the pregnancy. And that was, you know, in their minds, the best thing they could do for that child. Because, gosh, as parents, we want the best for our kids. And I think the thought of our children suffering in any way is the worst possible thing, you know? And we do so much to avoid that kind of situation. And so this was just another instance of that, protecting one's child from pain.
And to make light, I mean, to make that sound like a casual decision is terrible, because this poor family, I've walked with many families who've had to do this, and it is a scar, an emotional kind of wound on their soul for their whole lives.
And I'd just like to jump in, because we started this with talking about games, which sounds really frivolous. And yet what we do as community is we talk about these things. The way that we heal is we surround each other and we talk about it. That's the way it was in the pioneer days. And yet we've come to a society where we sort of push people off to grieve by themselves. And so when I talk about my love of games, part of it is because we heal through laughter, we heal through community, we heal through being able to talk about really difficult subjects. So that, I think, was the whole purpose of this Worth of a Woman project and pro-voice in general, is let's get the stories out. Let's become a compassionate group where we can talk about difficult subjects and we're not busy fighting each other in the midst of pain and joy and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think story is a way to engender empathy and understanding. And when we relegate reproductive health care to the political realm, it just turns into these black and white binaries and people shouting across the divide. But if we can share stories, we can all understand, like, oh, I'm a mother. I don't want my kids to suffer. Of course you didn't want your baby to suffer, you know? And we also can, it's tough to talk about reproductive health care. I mean, Jack, it's probably like, this maybe isn't your favorite show of the season to be talking about this. And like, oh no, what are these women going to say next? But this is, we need to be talking about this. You know, if we're going to restore access to reproductive health care here in Bonner County and across the state, we need to talk about it. That's how you fight for something. That's how you advocate for something. And so in talking about it, we challenge that stigma that sort of surrounds our reproductive systems, our bodies, our that form of healthcare, and just helps people open up to sort of connect and see their commonalities on this issue. So that's a big part of ProVoice project in general, but and definitely this Worth of a Woman exhibit specifically.
I'm going to ask Cynthia another question. You're involved in the Nurse Practitioners of Idaho. And of course, I think you talked to a number of members of the medical community. We think about the four OBs who left our community, but they aren't the only people involved in caring for women in our community. What's the response? What's the general attitude, if you can characterize it, among other nurse practitioners who you talk to, and anyone else in the community that you speak to? How are they responding to things that have transpired in about the last 18 months?
The most interesting thing I have noticed, and I have purposely gone out and tried to talk to people about this and talk to other providers, physicians, and nurse practitioners about this. And what's interesting is no one will talk about it to me. I mean, I'm just like the person on the street. I'm not going to run to, you know, our attorney general and told him what somebody said. It's I feel that we have driven women's health underground. It's such a disservice. We've already been there, and here we are again, 50 years later, fighting this stuff over again. So I feel that providers are being very, very careful, and they're not particularly talking to reporters, for sure. And we can't get any provider in this town to talk to a reporter. And they won't even talk with me so that I can kind of communicate, here's the things that people are struggling with as a medical provider. I think they're quickly sending people either out of Sandpoint to Coeur d'Alene, which is interesting because it's like, well, Coeur d'Alene is still in Idaho. But I think they're like, well, if we get it out of our door, it's another hospital situation, or of course, Washington or Montana even. So I feel like a lot of women are having to do a lot of travel, very difficult for some families and people to accomplish. So I would love for some people who are actually trying to navigate the complexities of women's health care in our current system, I would love to hear from them, like, what is the detail of how they're having to jump through hoops and go the extra mile to accommodate a woman's care?
I mean, it's an interesting question, and I wish we knew the answer.
I think I have heard, like, people have said they're careful what they write in a chart now. It's like, whoa, that's a little concerning.
Yeah.
That's not what we're educated to do.
Yeah.
We're not educated to be careful. We're educated to go just the facts.
Yeah. As in leaving out certain details or something like that.
Exactly.
That could be, mm-hmm. Yeah. In some way incriminating later on or something.
For sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll just throw in, you know, one more kind of caveat that Idaho is not really getting right is I went to a lecture last night about the Parental Rights Act that was just passed. Senate Bill 1329. This was passed with a transmittal letter by from Governor Little, that he was concerned that this Parental Rights Act that has now changed a minor's right to medical education to consent from the age of 14 to 18. So that means that no child under 18 can safely go to a medical provider, whether it's a counselor, their birth control clinic, their STD clinic, their family physician, nurse practitioner, so they can talk about their risk of depression or suicide without their parents having complete access to all of their medical records. And that goes into effect July 1. That's another program.
Right.
But I mean, it's
no,
like,
but it was a piece.
Underlining, like, okay, well, we've already been kicked in the gut, so now hit us again.
Yeah. And that, as you say, that has bearing on so many different things, mental health included, which is a huge concern. But I do want to bring that back around to reproductive health care and the stigma and shame that can be attached to going into a clinic and getting birth control or getting tested for sexually transmitted infections. And I think about my upbringing, you know, both of my parents hail from Catholic families, and the only sex talk that we really had when I was growing up was just don't. End of story. And from that place, I just felt a lot of shame around, you know, sexuality in general. And the thought of, like, my parents knowing if I had gone to a clinic to get birth control or whatever, that would have been barrier enough for me to not do it. And I think that's the case for a lot of kids, which is dangerous, because then if you're not going in to get tested, if you're not going in for birth control, then what are the outcomes of that?
True.
I just feel like we're in this era of legislated shame.
Yeah. And parents can create an environment where their children feel safe talking to them about this. Why are we legislating that?
Right.
I would like to take a short musical break. This is live radio, after all. This is community radio, and we play music on this station, too. This is a Jen, you actually sent me this one as just a suggestion, something that we could play, and it seems appropriate at this time. From 1992, this is Four Non-Blondes, and you will probably recognize this song. It's called What's Up. We'll be right back with more here on The Morning Show.
Get up that great big hill of hope for a destination.
You're listening to the KRFY Morning Show. This is our second edition of a three-part series about the worth of a woman, which is an exhibit going on at Bluebird Bakery right now, and that's what we're going to be talking about. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here with Jen Jackson-Quintano from the Pro Voice Project, Cynthia Dalsing, and Catherine Larson. Anything you want to say about that musical choice, Jen, before we move on?
Did you know that Dolly Parton recently covered that for her new album?
Did not know that.
It's fantastic. I highly recommend it. Well, it's on Dolly Parton's new rock album.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think she said, "I'm not rock and roll," when she got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
And then bless Dolly, because she said, "Well, actually, I am." Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Well, we're going to have to track down the Dolly Parton cover of that song by Four Non-Blondes. Let's talk about the exhibit going on at Bluebird Bakery right now. It's entitled Worth of a Woman. And I guess to... in what ways each of you contributed to that exhibit? Who wants to start this conversation?
I can start. Yeah. So, you know, we had this group of volunteers and we each kind of took on areas of interest to, you know, that played into our individual interests. And so I took on a few different topics. One was the systemic undervaluing of reproductive health care and women's health in general. And came across some fascinating statistics, some really fun ones. Like my favorite was learning that, so menopausal women face greater risk of heart disease due to the drop in estrogen that they experience. So researchers conducted a study on preventative hormone supplementation, and they enrolled over 8,000 men and no women in the study. Mm-hmm. Which is just sort of par for the course historically in studies like this, is to just not enroll women. And it's only recently that women do need to be enrolled in these sort of studies, but they tend to be underrepresented. Or if we look at menopause, you know, 85% of women suffer from menopause system, and we don't have like a clear standard of care for menopause, and only 1 in 5 OBGYN residents receives really any menopause training, which is kind of fascinating when 85% of women experience that. I mean, these statistics are like all over the place. What else? Even though 99% of sexually active women use contraceptives at some point in their life, the National Institutes of Health allocated 0.2% of its recent budget to birth control development. So those are some fun numbers. And there's 5 times more research into erectile dysfunction, which affects 19% of men, than into premenstrual syndrome, which affects almost 90% of women. So those statistics kind of paint a picture of just, like I said, the systemic undervaluing, lack of investment into women's healthcare issues. And so that affects the whole field.
You know? I have a great story about that, too, because I was talking to a plastic surgeon in Spokane. And we're all familiar with having to have prior authorization for procedures to be done. And one of the things this surgeon does is sometimes women, young girls, are born with perhaps missing one of their breasts. And so for her to do the surgery for that young woman or teenager, she would have to go through a lot of paperwork and get a prior authorization for insurance to pay for that procedure. And in the operating room next to her was a urologist who did penile implants. And he said he has never had to do a prior authorization. And I thought, now that's the classic systemic problem with women's healthcare. It's not just kind of a local, oh, we don't have OBs. I mean, it's nationally and it's built into our insurance structure.
Cynthia, what was your experience with this exhibit?
The panel? You contribute? Well, yeah. I have the graphs, which I love because they're kind of boring. Mm-hmm. But actually, I thought they were very interesting. And to summarize, because I looked at maternal mortality, and one of my reasons for being interested in this is because the Idaho legislature let the Maternal Mortality Review Committee sunset last year because they did not want to take federal money. And they said it took over a year to get the statistics. I mean, women are dying, but by God, we should not wait a year to get the statistics to learn how are these women dying and how can we prevent them. And one of the most important things that they found from this multidisciplinary team that would examine maternal deaths was that almost all of them can be prevented. So this group, doctors, nurses, nurse midwives, social workers, coroners, they all would get together and say, talk about how can we prevent this from happening in the future. And it really was real data for providers and communities to be able to say, oh, okay, we need to have more comprehensive postpartum care, which in fact the legislature did pass. So we now have 12 months of postpartum Medicaid, which is extremely important. But the legislator in 24 has now passed a shell of this committee that takes no federal money, and they're very proud of themselves. So when I looked at maternal mortalities, what struck me was that, of course, in 1900, and you'll see this on the graph, it was very high, like 800 per 100,000. But then in the 1980s, it dropped to 8 or 8.2 per 100,000. And we thought that was good. Meanwhile, our Scandinavian countries are at 0 to 1 deaths per 100,000. If you're in Sweden or Norway or Ireland or Iceland, they just do a better job of wraparound care in those countries. And what was interesting is our maternal mortality rates have now started to rise. And in the U.S., they are 32 per 100,000. I believe that data was from 2022. But in Idaho, it's 41 per 100,000. So Idaho is not looking good on this graph. And it's concerning because we've taken away a very comprehensive committee to look at why this is happening. But more importantly, we're really missing an opportunity to intervene and prevent deaths.
Catherine, what are you add to the exhibit at Bluebird Bakery right now?
So I was involved with two of the panels, and one of them is the map of the previously uncharted wilderness of women's health care. We were doing a lot of research around reproductive health care and even health care beyond that. And the comment that all of the volunteers kept having is, oh, really? Really? That's how our bodies work? So we it just sort of naturally morphed into this engaging map that I encourage you to go and explore. Jack donated his time to do the voiceover of the tours. And it's just a fun and educational exploration into things that would have been nice to have known 50 years ago. And then
it's
never
too late. It's never too late. I would posit it's never too early for it either, but that might be a controversial stance.
Anyway, yeah.
Please
so,
continue.
Anyway, it's a fun exhibit. There's also some panels around the history of women in Bonner County, and there's some stories of women who experienced birth here more recently, and there's an architecture panel on how would you craft healthcare for your future. So I encourage you all to go and engage and enjoy it.
The map, let me say, the map is amazing. So picture like when you were a kid and you read The Hobbit and there was the map at the back of the
That's
book.
Good. There's a ring in there.
That you could look through with all the mountain ranges and rivers and stuff. This is the map. It's the Hobbit map, but it is about our bodies and their cycles, and it's phenomenal. And I really do encourage people to scan those QR codes on the map so they can hear Jack as the tour guide for gynecologia, among other areas.
It really disarms the mystery of being female. And I feel like, having grown up, I mean, most of us can relate to this, that you didn't talk about being female or it was handled inappropriately in your family. So I feel like this is one of the healthiest, delightful ways to give validation to what women are really experiencing, girls and women.
And I can tell you, it blew my mind learning about all of this stuff at the ripe old age of 66. It's like, wow, who knew?
We are running very short on time. Is there anything else we need to say about the exhibit? Or I guess tell us how long it's going to be up and how people can go see it.
Yeah, it'll be at Bluebird Bakery until June 13th. And then we're going to find other venues for it around town because, oh my goodness, we put a lot of work into it and we want the conversation to continue. So please drop by Bluebird. And there are parts of the panels facing outside that you can check out and then inside as well.
It is just about 9 o'clock, and I'll let us go into our regularly scheduled programming. But first we should mention next week we'll be back with part three of this series. Who are we talking to next week, Jen?
We're going to speak to Professor Caitlin Myers, and she studies the economic harms of restricting reproductive freedom, which is fascinating. And then we'll also be speaking with Representative Lauren Nekcheya from Boise, who's very much involved in and invested in these issues.
Tune in next week. That's Tuesday, May 21st for that. Also, all these, after they air, all of these will be available on our website, krfy.org, and probably links elsewhere as well. With that, I'm about done, but I don't want to deprive anyone of a last word, if anybody wanted to say anything else.
No? Vagina.
Thank you very
Mic
much.
Mic drop. Mic
all
drop.
Right. Well, Cynthia Dalsing, thank you for that. And thank you also, Catherine Larson and Jen Jackson Quintana, once again for joining us. This is 88.5 KRFY Pondere, and we'll continue with our regularly scheduled programming now.